This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Are you ready to eat? Most Americans will be overstuffing themselves on stuffed turkeys and all the fixins, and I'm going to be among them. So let's talk about food today. I have a number of pieces about food, about raising it, eating it, and finding comfort from it. Novella Carpenter is highlighted on today's show. She's the author of Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. And she knows food from beginning to end. From KRFP, Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today our show is called Eat It. We start with a perspective on the future of food. And that's the name of a documentary by Deborah Coons Garcia. Yin Radio's Renee Pope brings us Deborah Coons Garcia talking about her views on farming and changing views around the country and the world about food.
There is a revolution happening in the farm fields and on the dinner tables of America, a revolution that is transforming the very nature of the food we eat. Deborah Coons Garcia, the creator of the documentary The Future of Food, came to Moscow September 23rd to promote her film and host a discussion afterward. The Future of Food offers an in-depth investigation into the disturbing truth behind the unlabeled, patented, genetically engineered foods that have quietly filled U.S. grocery store shelves for the past decade. This film gives a voice to farmers whose lives and livelihoods have been negatively impacted by this new technology. The health implications, government policies, and push towards globalization are all part of the reason why many people are alarmed by the introduction of genetically altered crops into our food supply. Shot on location in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, The Future of Food examines the complex web of market and political forces that are changing what we eat as huge multinational corporations seek to control the world's food system. The film also explores alternatives to large-scale industrial agriculture, placing organic and sustainable agriculture as real solutions to the farm crisis today. The discussion held after the movie lasted about 30 minutes and was very relaxed and casual. Here are some highlights. How do we effect real systemic change when so many of the individuals responsible for the oversight have links to the very corporations that they have responsibilities to control?
I think it's easier to create that change than maybe in other ways, because you have the co-op, you can buy food there, you know, you can grow your own food, you can go to farmers markets. It's actually much easier now than it was maybe 20 years ago to know where your food is coming from and to buy healthy food and to find out if it's in your community, if it's helping your community. It's much easier now to be able to eat a healthy diet and to support local farmers and to find out where your food is coming from than it's ever been.
How do you think the problem can be solved of the price of cheaper food versus organically grown food where people are choosing the cheaper food?
First of all, a lot of food is subsidized, so it's not cheap. It's just being subsidized. We're paying for it, and then that money could go to other things. On the one hand, I think farmers should get top dollar for their crops because, you know, that's a lot of work. But on the other hand, you know, food is expensive. But I also think that they are buying organic. They're just buying more in season. They're buying a lot of pasta. They're buying stuff, they're still feeding their families organically, they're just choosing more carefully. And I actually really believe that if people eat simply, and they buy in season, and they buy locally, and they don't eat big, massive amounts of meat and, you know, stuff like that, you can eat a healthy organic diet for not a lot of money. But you're going to have to cook it yourself, and you'll have to be simple.
Food labeling was a common topic discussed that evening. Europe is currently labeling all food that has been genetically modified, allowing the customer to make the decision whether or not to eat it. Has there been any progress on food labeling in the United States?
In the United States, there's a new development with Whole Foods and various organic people who are in the organic business. They have a thing, a GMO labeling campaign where they're labeling their stuff, GMO-free. And one of the things I want to do, I think we should have sign-up sheets in every food store in the country where people can sign up and say, I want, you know, genetically engineered foods labeled. You know, I think because they've done study after study, and it's really true, 80 to 90% of Americans want it labeled. But the government, you know, they have a very powerful industry. So I think it should happen. And Obama, when he was running, did say, when he was in Iowa, he did say that he thought it should be labeled. I don't know of any major bills that are making their way through this. The thing is, there's just so many huge issues that this just feels like a side issue. But I think with this kind of major push now for people to label what it's, you know, when they know for sure it's not in it, to label it, it just gets more in this idea that it's not there. Of course, if something's organic, then it's not GE anyway. So, but I think just the fact that people are going to start seeing that, no GMOs, no GMOs, I think it creates just that extra pressure where they go, well, why? I see no GMOs on this. I want to see it. I want to know everything it's in.
Another audience member mentioned the idea of labeling that would allow the customer to know where the food came from and the various chemicals used on it.
I agree with you. I think that's really important. I think it's becoming more and more important to people. You know, I don't think people, I mean, it used to be people wanted cheap food, and they still want cheap food. Cost is still a really major importance to most people. But the issue of, you know, do you want to eat cheap food that's from China? You know, what the hell's in it? Or you pay a little more and you eat something your neighbor grew. You know, that you know, there's other issues to cost besides just the dollars. You know, there's cost to health, there's cost to the environment, and that's what more and more people are thinking about. Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that I've, you know, heard about is this idea of, as technology advances, that when you check out at the grocery store, when you do the barcode, you'll be able to get, or even before that, you know, I've heard one scenario where you can actually run the barcode of what you want to buy in front of something. This is like in the future, it's not happening yet. But you can run it on something, and then you'll go up, it, on a screen will come all the information you want to know about where it came from.
Ms. Garcia has lived in Northern California for 30 years. Her other film credits include All About Babies, Poco Loco, and Grateful Dog, a documentary featuring her late husband, Jerry Garcia, of the Grateful Dead. If you would like more information about genetically modified food or to get involved in this movement, please go to www.thefutureoffood.com.
Renee Pope brought us that piece from Deborah Coons Garcia, who produced the documentary The Future of Food. Now, someone else who knows and really lives the idea of eating local and eating organic is Novella Carpenter. She moved from Seattle to a slum in Oakland, California, and that's where she started a garden in the abandoned lot next to her apartment. The garden grew and expanded, and she got chickens. She is a true urban farmer. Novella Carpenter wrote about her experiences as an urban farmer in her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. She talked about the book and read a few selections and showed some slides at the University of Idaho last month. Here's how she moved to raising meat birds, starting with a vegetable garden.
So, yeah, that was easy, you know, plant a vegetable garden, make it grow. And then one of the things that I started to think about is that I really wanted to start raising more animals. And I often call chickens sort of the gateway urban farming animal. And you can see it happening all the time now. Like, everybody has chickens now. It's totally crazy. That's how I sort of got into urban farming in the first place, was just raising chickens for eggs. And these are just probably a couple day old chicks from a hatchery. And then, of course, you know, you get eggs, you have these beautiful chickens, they make manure for the garden. It's this, you know, wonderful cycle of life. And then you get a box in the mail one day, and it's filled with geese and turkeys and ducks. And this was kind of, I was kind of addicted to Murray McMurray Hatchery, and so I keep ordering stuff through the mail. And the post office would deliver them, and it would be this moment of the postman would be like, what is this crazy girl doing? You know, this is like the total hood, and so people would wonder what's going on. So here's kind of what I was thinking when I ordered my first order of turkeys and meat birds. As I fiddled with the door to our apartment, the new box of fowl tucked under my arm, I recognized that I was descending deeper into the realm of the underground economy. Now that I had been in California for a few years, I felt ready for what seemed like the next logical progression, something I had never dared in the soggy Northwest, meat birds. I felt a bit nuts, yes, but I also felt great. People move to California to reinvent themselves. They give themselves new names, they go to yoga. Pretty soon they take up surfing, or Thai kickboxing, or astral healing, or witch camp. It's true what they say, California, the land of fruits and nuts. I knew you guys would like that. It's in Northern California, one is encouraged to raise his freak flag proudly and often. I got off on raising my own food. Not only was it more delicious and fresh, it was also essentially free. Now I was taking it to the next level. Some might say I had been swept up by the Bay Area's mantra, repeated ad nauseum, to eat fresh, local, free-range critters. At farmers markets here, and there is one every day, it isn't uncommon to overhear farmers chatting with consumers about how their steer from which their steaks were harvested, where their stewing hens ranged, and the view from the sheep pen that housed the lamb that was now ground up and laid out on a table decorated with nasturtium blossoms. Prices correspond with the quality of the meat, and Alice Waters assures us that only the best ingredients will make the best meals. But as a poor scrounger with three low-paying jobs and no health insurance, I usually couldn't afford the good stuff. Since I liked eating quality meat and have always had more skill than money, I decided to take matters into my own hands. One night, after living in our ghost town apartment for a few years, I clicked my mouse over various meat bird packages offered by Murray McMurray. They sold day-old ducks, quail, pheasants, turkeys, and geese through the mail. They also sold bargain-priced combinations, the barnyard combo, the fancy duck package, the turkey assortment. These packages, I had thought, might offer a way to eat quality meat without breaking the bank. But I had never killed anything before. Blithely ignoring this minor detail, I settled on the homesteader's delight, 2 turkeys, 10 chickens, 2 geese, and 2 ducks for only $42. I bought my poultry package with the click of the mouse and paid for it with a credit card. It was only after the post office delivered the box that I realized one can't just buy a farm animal like a book or a CD. What I now held in my hands was going to involve a hell of a lot of work. So then I put the chicks into a brooder, which is this, you know, you guys know what a brooder is. It's kind of funny to come to a place that's like, you know, you guys have like agricultural roots, so you're like, yeah, you went to a pig auction, who cares? But anyway, bear with me, okay? So anyway, I put them all into I'm putting them into the brooder. My boyfriend walks out, and he's like, oh, my God. Bill stumbled out of our bedroom wearing his boxer shorts, his hair mussed. Not a morning person. He glanced at the baby birds like they were a dream and then headed for the bathroom. The downy, almost weightless ducklings and goslings drank deeply, using their bills to slurp up large amounts of water. When I set them into the brooder, they waded their big orange feet into the water dish and splashed around. Water hit the side of the box and splashed the sleeping chicks, who awoke and began to peep in protest. Sensing this might be a disastrous species intersection, I lugged out an aluminum washtub and set out separate brooders for each of them. The baby birds were home now, warm and safe. The chicks scratched at their yellow feed just like our big chickens out back did. Sometimes they would stop mid-scratch and, feeling the warmth of the brooder light, fall asleep standing up. The puffy gray goslings curled their necks under the yellow sleeping ducklings. A Hallmark card had exploded in my living room. I called my mom. A brooder box full of fowl was something that woman could appreciate. She had once been a hippie homesteader in Idaho. Listen to this, I said, and held the phone near the brooder box, 100 little peeps. Oh my God, she said. 3 turkeys, 3 ducks, 2 geese, and 10 chickens, I crowed. I watched the chicks and poults moving around in their brooder. Turkeys? Do you remember Tommy Turkey, she said? I didn't, but the photo in our family album had stuck with me. My older sister, Rihanna, in a saggy cloth diaper, being chased by the advancing figure of a giant white turkey, Tommy. Mom told us about Tommy every time we got out the old photo album from the ranch days. Well, he was mean as hell, and he would chase you guys. I looked out the window while my mom was talking. Bill had made it downstairs where he was out front tinkering with our car. His legs peeked out from underneath our dilapidated Mercedes, and he rolled around amid the street's numerous Swisher's Sweet cigar butts. I had warned him about my meat bird purchase, and he had been excited about the prospect of homegrown meat. But now that he saw the baby birds, fragile, tiny, he seemed a bit skeptical. Tommy grew to be an enormous size, my mom said, and as back-to-the-land hippies, she and my dad had been very pleased. They didn't encounter any predator problems that year, and butchering him was a cinch. But disaster did hit. The smokehouse burned to the ground while they were smoking the turkey. Oh, no, I groaned. Life was like that, she said glumly. I felt sorry for her. My mom's stories usually involve some heroic hippie farm action. I hadn't heard this part of the story before, but I knew that bad things had happened. Her voice brightened. Even though the smokehouse burned down, we did manage to salvage the turkey. What do you mean, I asked. Well, we dug through the charred wood, and there it was, a perfectly cooked turkey. I brushed off all the cinders and served him for dinner. She paused and smacked her lips, a noise that was repellent to me as a teenager, but now filled me with hope. It was the best turkey I've ever had, she declared. We said our goodbyes, and I hung up the phone. I glanced into the cozy chick brooder. The chicks slept on their mattress of shredded pages from the New York Times. I had to remind myself that though they were cute, these baby birds would eventually become my dinner. Thanksgiving, in particular, was going to be intense. I imagined the killing scene, a butcher block, an axe, three giant Tommy turkeys I had known since polthood. I wasn't sure I could bring myself to do it. But the conversation with my mom left me emboldened for my foray into killing and eating animals I had raised myself. This urge was clearly part of my cultural DNA. I wondered if this would prove that I could have it both ways, to sop up the cultural delights of the city while simultaneously raising my own food. In retrospect, though, I wonder why I thought my experience would be any less disastrous than my parents'.
That's Novella Carpenter, and she tells the rest of her story about raising meat in her book and on her blog, which you can find at novellacarpenter.com. Now, I talked to Novella about her experiences harvesting her meat birds, something that most of us are loath to even think too much about. Novella shares what she has learned in courses, and she teaches courses on how to slaughter backyard farm animals all around the country. Now, her first experience in that arena was one of those fluffy poults that she talked about in the last segment. It was a Thanksgiving turkey.
And like I said, I mean, the first animal that I killed was my Thanksgiving turkey. And that was part of this whole thing where I realized that every year I eat a turkey for Thanksgiving and I don't think anything of it. You know, it's like I buy it at the store, it's fine. And then I started thinking, you know, tracing back what's going on with that turkey. Where did it live? And so then I started buying like organic free-range turkeys and that seemed fine for a while. And then I started to really be, you know, questioning my level of knowledge about eating any kind of food. And I had been vegetable gardening and keeping chickens and raising bees. And so I had started to sort of follow the path of those stories, like this is where honey comes from. It involves all these steps, all this work. This is how you plant vegetables. You get the seeds, you plant them, you water them, you know, all of that stuff. And so when you start doing that with animals, it's the same thing. Like I have, you know, what are these steps that happen? And so when I was preparing, I'd raised my turkey. And, you know, people get really focused on the sort of like the moment of death. But the more important time is actually the time where they're growing, you know, when their life, like just to give them the best life as possible. The turkeys I raised were heritage breeds. So they take about 6 months to fatten up and get to a harvestable size. And, you know, that in contrast to factory-farmed turkeys, which grow in this enormous rate, put on all this really, you know, fat and huge breasts and all of this stuff, because that's what the palate of the American diet is to have a really, you know, big-breasted, big bird, you know, that's raised in these conditions where it never gets exercise or access to outdoors or the company of friends and, you know, that kind of thing. So so those are the moments that are the most important, in my opinion. My job as the person who's the farmer is to, you know, there was a moment when I was sort of like, can I really do this? I've raised this turkey for 6 months. It's been in my farm. We've spanned time together, you know, it's sort of things have happened. I named my turkey, you know, those kind of things. But then you wonder, you know, and as a meat eater, it's something that I think it's a good idea to face those kind of questions. And so I really did. I was like, can I do this? You know, can I kill this turkey? And so in some ways it was sort of, I don't know how to say it, but it was a way to just pronounce that I'm not a vegetarian. You know, it's sort of like, I have vegetarian friends, I have vegan friends. They were always trying to get my turkey to come live with them. Or, you know, you start to look at the end. What is the end game in raising a turkey? You know, is it going to go live on a farm for the rest of its life? Is that even natural? That's not even natural. And so, I learned how to do it by reading this book. I was so horrified. I was very nervous about it the night before. And then I just felt like, you know, I'm a farmer. This is the bargain that the turkey and I have as a human and a turkey. And so I went forward. I had a friend come over and he helped me and was a support, and it was really nice. And now the class that I'm teaching with this is, I teach classes with a woman named Samin, and it's really nice. She spent time in Italy, and it's something that Italian grandmothers do. You know, they kill chickens together, they sit and gossip and pluck the feathers, and it's all part of village life in these smaller towns in Italy. And I think we kind of, our idea in teaching classes like this is to kind of bring that back, that idea of, you know, it is hard work, and it is considered by many people to be drudgery and something that normal city people don't even have to do anymore. It's kind of a postmodern idea, right? That you could go buy a chicken at Whole Foods, you know, easily and pay like $16 for it. Or you could raise your own, takes, you know, 6 months and all these things. But, you know, for me, it's really important to actually try to do those things, like try to get back to a craft and to have skills. So I don't feel kind of like disempowered. You know, I don't know how to do anything. I know how to like type an email. I mean, that's not really a skill.
You are a meat eater, and you're teaching these classes to meat eaters. And, of course, you've seen that some people want to eat less meat. You pretty much advocate meat eating?
I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't say I'm a meat eating advocate. Meat eating is one of the worst things you can do for the planet. And I mean, in terms of just land use and you know, methane production with cows, and I mean, factory farms are something like 90% of the animals eaten are raised in factory farm situations in America. And so I guess I'm just the 1%. So my problem, here's the issue, is I am an advocate. I guess I am. I'm advocating a certain kind of meat eating, which is you are doing it with full intent. And so I think that's how it's different. I'm actually reading Eating Animals, the book by Jonathan Safran Foer. And, you know, he's chosen to be a vegetarian. And he's written a whole book about how he came to this decision and all of those things. And I agree. I think that people should eat less meat. But the problem is we just eat meat, you know. And we know there's things that we're supposed to do. We're supposed to stop driving cars, you know. We should probably blow up dams, you know. All of these things that we know about, we should, like, destroy these cell phones tomorrow. It's horrible. But we do. It's part of our culture. And so the only thing that I think of is that we can't just stop cold turkey. Not intended. We have to actually have
a correct solution. You know, we have to have a path that we can divert ourselves, our energy toward. You can't just stop. You just can't stop the sort of like, you know, the trundle of whatever you want to call it, technology or advances. And that is what factory farming is. Factory farming was, and I can totally see how farmers got involved with it. It is the most productive way to raise as much meat as possible. To the horrible suffering of animals and the horrible suffering of the people that work at these in these factories. And so when you start looking at those factories, yes, I want to shut those factories down too. But I know that people still want to eat meat. And there's no way to just stop that from happening. So I'm an advocate of eating meat with intent. And I mean, I'm not saying everybody should raise their own meat, but I think that we should probably just eat less meat, probably.
What about the vegetarians that attended this class so far?
They're really interesting. I mean, I even had a vegan come to a turkey slaughtering class that I did. And part of what he wanted to be part of this he wanted to see that what he's against, you know. And I think the problem is it's like talking about religion. You can't get together with it's hard for us meat eaters and vegetarians and vegans to all be in the same room and not just start this like fight. It's very personal. It's like what we put into our bodies. It's as personal as sex. And so people are very touchy, and they don't, you know, we have no way to talk about it in a way. So whenever a vegan or vegetarian comes to one of my classes, I'm so excited because I agree with them. For the most part, I totally agree with, I mean, especially vegans, you know. And so I want to talk to them about what they see and what their process is. And most of them say to me the same thing, which is that if you're going to eat meat, this is the only way to do it. Raising it yourself, killing it yourself, and, you know, sort of shouldering the sort of weight of the thing. So usually they're pretty respectful, and it's been a surprise for me.
And that makes me think of what you said earlier about how this is seen as, I don't know your phrase, but grunt work.
Yeah.
The toil of farming, you know, that it's, mm-hmm. it's less than being able to type an email.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, this is you're talking about when we compare those two styles of living. I don't know exactly how I want to phrase this. I guess what's so bad about subsistence is kind of.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. But you talk to people, you know, it's funny because there's like different kinds of people, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people, for instance, like maybe people who like write for the New Yorker or something. And I often find more resistance on the East Coast to these ideas because it's sort of like, what's the point of killing a chicken? I can just go buy one, you know. And there's no like sort of... they don't want to know the backstory. The backstory has been like taken care of, and maybe it's just because they're usually more intense city people, you know. So they're not necessarily like seeing farmland on a, you know, regularly when they drive out, you know, a couple hours out of a city. So I think that there's that kind of like distaste. There's also immigrant groups who move here and they're like, that's what my parents did, or that's what I did in Vietnam, and I don't want to do that here, you know. And that's some of my neighbors, you know, feel this. They laugh because, you know, I'm like, I'm getting ducks, and they're sort of like, oh my god, we kept ducks. But they're like, we don't want to do that anymore. Actually, it's nice to not have to do that, because it is a lot of hard work, and, you know, animals die or predators get to them, or they get sick, and, you know, so it's a risky business. For sure. And so it's not always like pleasant, you know. Urban farming is not like this idyllic kind of thing. So I think that it's valid, you know, to have that argument. Like, I don't want to do that, that grunt work. And some people don't like, for instance, the African Americans in my community, some of them that are old enough to have lived in the South when times were really hard, they remember their grandparents were slaves. I mean, they don't want to like go grow collard greens, you know. That's not what they want to do. That there's a cultural history there. So, I mean, I'm sensitive to it. I'm like, hey, my parents were back to land hippies. It's in my DNA to want to grow food, you know. Like, I just can't deny it, and so I run with it. But, you know, I can totally understand people resisting it, not wanting to do it. I mean, it's lucky, though, because a lot of people really do like to farm. It is really an amazing thing and a gift, and it makes you connected to the natural world, and so I'm happy to do it.
That is urban farmer Novella Carpenter. She is featured on this Yin Radio show that I have dubbed Eat It. Now, from vegetables and bees to laying chickens and then to meat birds, Novella expanded her urban farming experiences, all because of bacon.
So the ducks and the geese, they all grew up, and there were problems, which you'll have to read about if you buy my book. But it involves me with a shovel killing a predator. So then on to this sort of, if the metaphor is that chickens are the urban farming gateway animal, then, you know, you do the ducks, and then you do bees, and then you do rabbits, right? Which, for a lot of people, you know, they're not going to go there because rabbits are really cute, and who wants to eat them? The problem is, like I mentioned, that's me and my sister. Those are not pet rabbits that we're holding there. That was our dinner. So in some ways, it was kind of how we were raised, is that rabbits make good eating. And if you've ever had, you know, like the hippie fried chicken, that's probably rabbit people, okay? So don't kid yourself that you haven't had rabbit before. It's just part of our life in Idaho was eating rabbits. Okay, well, so now pigs. Okay, but this was, you know, in my slippery slope falling into the kind of, this is more like if chickens were marijuana, the pigs were like cocaine or like crystal meth. They were purely motivated by pleasure, which is eating bacon, right? I mean, you know, as I had been a vegetarian when I was in high school partially through college, And I forced my family actually to become vegetarians when I was a vegetarian in high school. And I hope you guys did that to your family as well, because that's very satisfying. And my mom still talks about how, like, for, I don't know what it was, 3 years, she never ate ribs, pork ribs. And she's, like, still is kind of angry at me about that. So, you know, I kind of wanted to, like, you know, make up for it. So I got pigs. Now, remember, we live in the city. And, but, you know, kind of a ghetto, so we can get away with it. Bill and I really were in big trouble. But here's kind of what we were thinking about that. So this is them in the crate when we just bought them. We were the only people that went to the, how many people have been to a swine auction in this room? Yes, you are my people. Don't you love it? I feel like if I wished that I lived in a rural area so that I could just go hang out at a swine auction like every other weekend, because like I get an adrenaline rush, like it really, it's in my heart. I'm just like, oh God, this is so awesome. There's something about the bidding. I get really confused. And then something about the numbers too, like you're flying up the numbers. And anyway, I ended up with two pigs, even though I really only had room for one. But the story is that we brought a station wagon to load the pigs up into. I don't know if you guys have ever done that at your swine auction, but it was very uncool. And I remember we were backing the car up, and everyone's like got their Dodge Ram, and they're all looking at us like, what the hell are these people doing? But we had this crate, and it was very nice, but it smelled so bad. I couldn't believe how bad these pigs smelled. And we had a 3-hour drive home, so just think about that. Back in the ghetto, I herded the pigs into their new home. It was just getting dark. The air felt heavy but wasn't raining. In the morning, and in anticipation of the piglets, I had enhanced the chicken area with a bucket filled with water and a feeding trough. I also tipped a barrel sideways with the idea that the pigs would sleep in it. Safely behind the closed gate of their yard, the pigs seemed mildly curious, but far from geniuses stamping out Morse code with their cloven feet, thank God. They ran around kicking up sawdust as they had in the ring a few hours ago. The chickens came down from their roost to investigate their new house guests. The piglets sniffed at the chickens, which caused a panic, and the chickens retreated back to the house for the night. As they checked out their surroundings, they made quiet grunting sounds. I wondered if the city noises, a police helicopter circling the hood, someone yelling at the junkyard dogs next door, would be a shock to their system.
They had, after all, lived in the deep country, all trees and pastures. But if they were disturbed by the city's smells and sounds, they made no sign of it. Pigs, I was glad to see, are not very sensitive. And then I talk about why we wanted to do it, which is basically just pork, which you guys all know about pork. Bill and I looked at the pigs in their pen as they nosed around the corners of their area. They stood in front of their gate and smiled up at us expectantly. We read their minds. Where's the pig chow? On cue, we jumped into the car and raced over to Chinatown. That night, for the first time ever, Bill and I threw open the dumpsters with our hearts and minds. Oh, you should know, we've been dumpster diving. So part of the whole thing about raising animals in a city is that, and you guys know this from like your cafeteria probably, is there's so much waste, you know, that could be used to feed animals. So this was our idea about Chinatown. So we threw open the dumpsters with our hearts. Will they eat, we wondered, these soggy pieces of Chinese donut? I discovered yes. These chunks of leftover duck from the restaurant window in which everything exudes a steady flow of oil, including this duck head? Yes. Wontons and dumplings covered with somehow frosting? Yes. Grapes, watermelon, egg-fried rice? Yes, yes, yes. Bill and I anxiously unloaded our two buckets of slop from the car. We had never collected such a disgusting assortment of salty and sweet, meat and vegetable. But pigs, I had heard, were omnivorous, and so we were respecting that. When we walked through the gate to the backyard, we were greeted by two grunts, one deep, demanding, the other soft, questioning. I hefted a bucketful of Chinatown into the metal wash tub. The pigs began feeding before the second bucket was empty, so I ended up pouring a load of grapes and wontons over their heads and watched it bounce all over their shoulders and land on the ground. Their focus was amazing. While they ate, the pigs let out small sighs of approval. Their lip smacking was audible. At times, they would stop chewing and simply suck up the juices from the trough through their nostrils. They were the best dinner guests ever. The pigs stopped eating for a moment and gazed up at us. Their mouths moved continuously. Their chins were smeared with frosting and grease. Now that I thought of it, these pigs had probably never had food like this before. They had probably only had their mother's milk, a few handfuls of pig chow, and maybe a rotten apple. Now they were eating Chinese, like good urban pigs. So they got really huge, which you guys know, pigs get big, yeah. They approached around the 300-pound level. That was in my backyard, and I started to feel like I had monsters living in my backyard. And Bill and I would have to go out. We started to, as you guys maybe know, you are the pig's bitch. Like, you have to feed them all day long. And they would just make noises, and that's their, like, little trough where it's, like, feeding on the in the metal wash tub thing. That thing would be filled with food, and they would eat it, and then they'd look up at me like, where's the rest, you know? So one of the things that I discovered is that I wanted to, you know, through my very, very arduous research, I figured out that I wanted to raise them, you know, eating the best food possible with the idea that, you know, we would be able to, you know, have like organic pork if we could find these restaurants. The good thing is that in the Bay Area, there's lots of these restaurants and they waste a lot of food. And so this is a journey that we took that was really like probably the low point of Bill and my relationship, but at the time we had no idea. Driven by the pig's desires, that evening Bill and I decided to journey with our station wagon, now called the Slop Bucket, into a new frontier, the Tony part of Oakland, where high-end restaurants were springing up like mushrooms. We cruised past Restaurant Row and slipped through the gate in the back where all the restaurants shared their dumpsters. We left the car running and scurried like rats into the yawning maw of waste. What the hell, Bill said, lofting an entire clear garbage bag filled with still warm Spanish rice. Like idiots, we'd only brought three buckets. Bill gently laid the bag in the back of the car. I took the plunge and fished out an entire pizza, only slightly burned. In 5 minutes, we had found a squashed key lime pie, a bag of still warm beans, and a container of old romaine lettuce. Even though it was approaching midnight, we felt like Vegas gamblers on a winning streak, and we weren't going to quit while we were ahead. We continued on, driving to the bread-filled dumpsters of life for a suckle. The dumpsters are these, it's a bakery. They were filled to the brim, as usual. A few gutter punks sifted through the dumpsters. One had climbed in. They saw us and started to scatter. "We come in peace," I said when we got out of the car. We wandered up to the bin. In order to dissuade dumpster divers, the bakery had been locking the lids with padlocks. I had figured out that the combination for the locks was the street number of the bakery. But the other scroungers and punks, when they found the locks, promptly cut them. The following night, new locks would appear. These were then broken. Someone scrawled the obvious on the side of the dumpster in a silver pen: "This is war." It looked like the bakery had finally surrendered. The locks were gone now. "Looking for something special?" I asked the kid with a mohawk and a nose piercing. "Cinnamon twist," he mumbled, tossing whole baguettes and bags of dinner rolls out of the way. This was the bakery's holy grail, an eggy sweet loaf spiked with cinnamon that best of all came secured in a plastic bag. I grabbed whatever loaves were closest. I dropped a few on the dusty pavement, then picked them back up and threw them in the car. I looked back at the punks who, watching me, seemed a little repulsed, not knowing that they were for the pigs. I waved as Big Bill snagged a few stale baguettes for the rabbits, and we were on our way. Though it was late, I wanted to hit one more spot. I had heard through the grapevine about a fancy Italian place on 4th Street in Berkeley. 4th Street is a luxury shopping district complete with a Sur La Table, an Aveda cosmetic store, and bars that sell $20 glasses of wine. "Whole chickens," my source, a fellow dumpster diver who mostly scrounged for vegetable oil to power his car, whispered when describing the dumpster at Ecolo Restaurant. The pigs needed protein. Maybe they would prefer roasted roasted free-range chicken carcasses to Chinatown fish guts. I know I would. We drove under the cover of night to 4th Street. Bill idled the car, and I dashed behind the metal door in the Ecolo dumpster. The rumor was true. Whole, fragrant chicken carcasses. Pawing through the pile, I got so caught up in the bounty, fennel stalks, bread soaked in olive oil, that I didn't notice when the gate creaked open. "Please explain to me what you're doing," a man in a blue Italian suit demanded. I was caught. I placed the two chicken carcasses I clutched in my hand into the buckets and slowly turned to face him. The headlamp I use for nighttime foraging shined in his eyes. He raised an arm to ward off the beam, squinting angrily. I fumbled with the headlamp to turn it off. "Well," I said, assessing the situation. I could lie. I could say I was a mother of five struggling to make ends meet. Then I decided that the truth is stranger than fiction. "I have two pigs near downtown Oakland," I panted, "and they're really hungry." "Compliments get you everywhere, I know that. And this is the best dumpster in Berkeley." The man smirked. I could smell his very subtle cologne. I didn't want to think about what I smelled like. "It's a believable story," he congratulated me, brushing his hands together. "Proceed." I turned my light back on and went back to foraging. "You know," the manager guy said before shutting the gate, "you should really talk to Chris." "Who's Chris?" I asked, throwing some carrots into the bucket. "The owner and the chef," the man said as he walked away. "Why is that?" "He might take an interest in your pigs," he said mysteriously. He sauntered back into the restaurant to help sell more $35 pork chops. Buckets overwhelmingly full, Bill and I drove away. The Ecolo smells wafted around the car. I suddenly felt very hungry. "What'd that guy say?" Bill said. "That I should talk to some guy named Chris." The beans, the chicken, the bread, that was one fine meal for the pigs, and then some, because we got enough food to feed them for 2 whole days. If we could stockpile like that more often, we wouldn't have to go to the dumpster every night. The rabbits and chickens had never been this demanding. We had ventured out only twice a week for them. The pigs were another story. I did the math, assuming 2 meals per day, only about 260 left to find. So they kicked our butts, but then we kicked their butts. I know, it's horrible, I'm sorry. A lot of people gasp openly when they see this picture. I'm glad you guys didn't. So
those are the pig's heads in a bucket, just for you that can't focus on what you're seeing. And I like to think that the pigs actually have a really optimistic look in their eye. Like, they're kind of like, what's up? And then it's over. Because they really did have a wonderful life. I mean, I'm being lighthearted. I really do. I felt very attached to the pigs, and it was a big deal, as anybody knows, when you're a farmer and you're taking your animals to the market. And so I wanted to make sure that they had a good death. So one of the great things is that the hands there that are holding that shoulder there, that is Chris Lee's hands, the owner of Echolo Restaurant. So the beautiful thing is Chris did want to talk to a dumpster diver who came to his restaurant in the cover of night. And when he found out I was dumpster diving, he was like, why are you doing this? And I was like, pork. And he's like, okay. And so... It was like, yeah, it was like being at a speakeasy, and I just had to say the magic word. But he had been trained in Tuscany by a famous Italian butcher there, and so he was very, he's this master of meat, and it's an amazing thing, and it was really humbling to be in his presence. I took the biggest pig, big guy, to be broken down, butchered by Chris. And we made things like salami and prosciutto and amazing things that I'd never heard of. With the pigs' heads, we actually made this thing called soppressata, which is you take this big stock pot, huge stock pot, and you put the pigs' heads in there with some feet. Are you guys writing this down? and the tail. And you just cook those heads like all day long for a million hours. And then you sit there and pull all the meat off their heads. And it's really an amazing experience for people who are just, you're just like, I just want a pork chop, That, to see that happening, where we were breaking down a pig, we were using every single part of it, we were using the feet and the head, was really an amazing way to honor the animal. And so I'll be eternally grateful to Chris Lee for his help showing me this thing that is salvaging this life and using every single bit of it. Because, after you raise a pig for 6 months and you're hand feeding it dumpster dived scraps, we had gone kind of crazy. And to have this moment of total relief and an honor of this pig was really just, it was really wonderful for us. So the pork's all gone. It's been about 2 years now, so sadly. And now I'm starting to think like, well, maybe I should get pigs again.
Novella Carpenter, urban farmer and author of Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. Keep up with Novella and her continuing education at novellacarpenter.com. Now, in this next installment, Renee Pope and I went around town to ask people about comfort food.
The holiday season is upon us, and that means, for most of us, cuddling up on the couch with a warm blanket, sipping hot tea, and eating warm, home-cooked meals. For many, the holidays are a time surrounded by food. I know in my house, growing up, my mother always had something cooking on the stove and baking during the cold winter months. To this day, I still miss her homemade chili and freshly baked cookies that always remind me of the winter months. It's no wonder, then, that cookies are a comfort food throughout the year for me. Whenever I'm feeling stressed or overwhelmed, there's nothing like a warm cookie fresh out of the oven to make me feel better. I got to wondering what some other comfort foods that people enjoyed were. I asked several women around town that very thing. What is your favorite comfort food, and why?
Ice cream.
Why is it ice cream?
Because it's soothing and cool and creamy and delicious. Ice cream. Everybody, when you're sick, that's like, you either get Jell-O or ice cream. And Jell-O sucks.
My favorite, home-cooked food is homemade curry. Spicy. Deliciousness. Vegetarian. And actually, I like to eat that when I'm sick, too, because it's spicy.
Why does spice make you feel better when you're sick?
It's good when you have a head cold. Macaroni and cheese, the SpongeBob character one. I know, it's easy to make. It's warm. Makes me feel happy.
I think it's a pepperoni stick, and I think it's because when I was little, I'd go to the buffet with my grandparents in like Golden Corral or something, and they'd always have all that pepperoni sliced for you at the salad bar, and it just felt like it was exciting, I guess. And also, I'm a huge meat eater, and I think meat just comforts me.
Cheesecake, because it reminds me of my childhood. Chocolate, because it just always tastes good no matter what mood you're in.
What's comfort food?
Macaroni and cheese. Tuna mac. Tuna mac. It smells like tuna.
Chocolate.
Hot chocolate.
Sour gummy worms.
Sour gummy worm. That was different.
From Winco.
What's your favorite comfort food?
Hot dogs, rice, and chili with cheddar cheese on top. So you make some rice in a rice cooker. And you take some hot dogs and you throw it into one can of chili. And you can add a little bit of water or a little bit of salsa to spice it up a bit. And you cook it all together until the hot dogs are cooked. Then you put a layer of rice on your plate and a hot dog, and you pour chili on top of it, and then you grate a ton of cheddar cheese on top of that. And then I like to cut up my little hot dog into little slices and then mix it all together. And this is a meal that I used to eat at my father's house every other weekend when I went there. And we had it every Friday.
Comfort foods. I guess I think of warm, like soups or chilies or stews, something that my mother would make.
Shoe fly by an apple pan dowdy, I'll never get enough of that wonderful stuff.
The question is, what's comfort food for you?
Oh, comfort food. Can I have this thing unclipped from my ass? I like pumpkin pie. I like the Thanksgiving meal. And I really like cereal. Anything really with milk in it, I like.
Comfort food? Comfort food for me is food that my husband makes for me. Because it's just, I know how much effort he's put into it, and it's all about love.
And what kind of food is it?
Egyptian food. Egyptian food is probably my comfort food.
What is Egyptian food like?
Oh, it
Sub yogurt.
Has a lot of different...
Lemon?
Lemon and yogurt? Cumin, some curry, rice, mashi, which is grape leaves with seasoned rice inside, koshuri. I don't know. It's just always food that you feel completely satisfied after eating.
Favorite food?
Apples with almond butter.
Well, chocolate, of course. Yeah, what else? I'm old.
I think just a cup of coffee.
That's not food.
I would imagine, you know, soups and stews and decent breads, garlic potatoes and cookies. Lots and lots of cookies.
What are comfort foods for you?
Ooh, chicken pot pie and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Korean food. That's it.
She's all, no.
My favorite comfort food? Ooh, I don't know. Probably everything, yeah, definitely. I really like manicotti and just any kind of Italian food with a lot of cheese and pasta.
Oh, man. Chocolate, of course. I also like pierogies. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're like, they're like a pasta that's filled with like mashed potatoes, kind of. They're really good. You can get them at Winco. And I like to fry them. They're really good fried. Let's see, what else do I like? Does it have to be a food? Okay. I like tea and apple cider.
Together?
Or no, oh. No, separate. I'll have them instead of, like, chocolate, or because I know I shouldn't have chocolate all the time. But, yeah, chocolate. I have a gumball machine at my apartment, and we filled it with M&Ms last week, and it's, like, almost gone because we eat a lot of chocolate.
I want some food.
I need some food.
Don't mean to be rude.
I love food.
What's for dinner?
What's for dinner?
Make it a winner.
Make it a winner.
Make it taste good.
Make it taste good.
Good food should.
Like good food should.
I'm hungry. Can't wait. I'm hungry. Lick the plate. I'm hungry. Tastes great. I love food. I'm hungry. Can't wait. I'm hungry, lick the plate. I'm hungry, tastes great. I love food.
Can I have some now?
I love that chow.
Right to the top.
Don't let it stop. Oh, yum, yum, yum.
Just let it spill. Just
you can listen to past shows, or you can podcast this show, or sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Yin Radio at V is in voice, P is in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and it's heard on outstanding radio stations around the country. Support your local radio station. They need funds to keep bringing you the programs that you can't get anywhere else. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host, and opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Assistant producer is Renee Pope. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, and we're listening to I Love Food from Skip's Animal Company. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.
I'm hungry. Tastes great. I love food. I'm hungry. Can't wait. I'm hungry. Lick the plate. I'm hungry. Tastes great. I love food.
I still want some food.
I still need some food.
I don't mean to be rude.
But I love food. What's for dinner?
What's for dinner?
Make it a winner.
Oh, make it a winner.
Make it taste good. Oh, I love that good food. Like good food should.
I'm hungry. Can't wait. I'm hungry. Lick the plate. I'm hungry. Tastes great. I love food.
Gimme, 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 gimme.
I'm hungry. Can't wait. I'm hungry. Lick the plate. I'm hungry. Tastes great. I love food. I love food.
I love food.
Yeah.